We get takeaways from the United Nations Climate Report out this month on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thousands of pages, years in the making. It's a detailed look from scientists across the world, including one at UW-Madison, who is a lead author. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, said the report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change shows we are on a fast track to climate disaster, but
a shift to renewables will mend our broken global energy mix and offer hope to millions of people suffering climate impacts today.
Join in on the report, consequences for inaction, hopeful signs around you, what you have wondered about the climate. 800-642-1234. Greg Nemeth is a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, one of the lead authors on the UN Climate Change Report. Greg, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. It's good to be here.
Well, the UN Secretary General's very bleak, stern message to the world, that is very haunting. It stays with me that we're perilously close to tipping points headed for climate disaster. Juxtapose that, as you consider yourself a climate optimist, what did you take away from the tone of these thousands of pages?
Yeah, that's a good question, because the tone of the report was a little bit difficult to figure out how to portray it. And I think it's because there's two strands of thinking going on. One is that, this climate problem is getting worse. We're not on track to actually meet the commitments that we made internationally at the Paris Agreement in 2015. And yet, on the other hand, there are signs of progress. And these signs of progress are more than just green shoots. They're countries that have reduced their emissions in sustained efforts for more than 10 years. Its technology is getting better. So both of those things are happening. The problem is getting worse, but the solutions are getting better. But if we're going to take advantage of the opportunities that come from having these solutions available now, we need to get started quickly. We need to start reducing emissions immediately and get to zero. And that's the main message of the report.
Right, because we kept hearing this phrase, the window of opportunity. The window of opportunity is closing, which I think refers to, in the report, is, to stop warming from getting so bad that humanity is unable to adapt. Is that in the neighborhood there? Is that right?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. So the window comes from how much temperatures have risen in the atmosphere. And if we think about 200 years ago, before the societies developed and industrialized, that was stable temperature. We're now 1.1 degrees Celsius higher, so about 2 degrees Fahrenheit higher. And we made this commitment in the Paris Agreement in 2015 to avoid warming above 2 and make efforts to keep it below 1.5. So we're, two-thirds of the way to 1.5. And so the window is between 1.1 degrees and 1.5 degrees, where the impacts, get a lot worse than what we're already seeing today.
Right, because we kept hearing the 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. And, for someone who's not a scientist, that can kind of get it. That's really hard to visualize or really apply that to your daily life. And can you help? I just paint a picture of what that means in the context of our warming planet.
Yeah, absolutely. It is hard to portray, I think, because it are not abstract units. These are units we're used to in everyday life. And 2.7 degrees of temperature change sounds like, walking into the shade is often a bigger change than that. So it doesn't sound that dramatic on its own. But when you have global temperatures rising at that amount, that puts us, we start to get into the range of, 20,000 years ago, when there was a mile of ice on top of Madison because of the ice age. They were talking about cooling on the order of 4 to 6 degrees Celsius. So a little bit of cooling like that, created these massive ice sheets. We're talking about going into the other direction, not up to 3 or 4 degrees, but even to 1.5 or 2 degrees means having more and more intense episodes of what we're already seeing, which around the world is wildfires and floods and extreme rain events and sea level rise. And in Wisconsin, the biggest thing has been intense rainfall events, and in the future would be more impacts associated with warmer temperatures and higher humidity, which at some point becomes really difficult to be outside on really warm days. And that's what we're trying to avoid. That's what's in play in our state and for the whole world. So that when we talk about a window, it's a window to avoid those impacts happening.
Talking with Greg Nemet, who is a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, one of the lead authors of the United Nations latest climate change report, which was published this month. You can join in with your questions about the report, questions about the warming planet, 800-642-1234. One of the findings being widely reported is that emissions are projected to peak by 2025, and that finding has caused some confusion. Can you explain what that finding means?
Well, yeah, for emissions, for us to reach net zero, which is how we get to avoid these worst climate impacts, we need to start reducing emissions, you know, by 2025 and then get on a very steep pathway to getting to zero over the next, say, three decades to the mid-century. So, you know, we've been increasing emissions in the last 10 years. They've been increasing, but less than they were before that. And so it's really the time to turn around the ship and really start reducing emissions overall, beginning in 2025, and then really steeply reducing them after that. It's a hard thing to do because we've got a growing world population. We've got people increasing their consumption and their incomes and aspiring to high consumption lifestyles. But on the other hand, we are seeing improvements, and we saw between 18 and 24 countries have reduced their emissions overall in the last 10 years. And that includes the US. And so there are indications that we have countries going in the right direction. They need to go faster, and that activity needs to spread to other places. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it's already happening is provides a model to other places to employ as well.
If there is something I hear in this report, is that this is really global. We have to solve it together. And that is also quite worrisome. So if the U.S. is accounting for about 13% or so of global emissions, a share for China, you know, the largest emitter, nearly three times that, how do scientists think you get nations to work together to partner on something that is much bigger than them individually to do the right thing here? This is a tall order.
Yeah, it's a tall order. It's a difficult challenge. It's purely global. Like, one of the issues is that when you put CO2 in the atmosphere, say somewhere in Wisconsin, it gets mixed up around the world in about a year. So where the impacts happen and where the emissions come from, there's no connection at all. It's just one global stock of CO2 in the atmosphere. So it is a truly global public goods problem. And that's the way climate policy has been approached since the late 1980s, when we really started trying to address it. But what's been a big shift in the last, let's say, since the Paris Agreement in 2015, is to say, well, that's kind of a top-down model. Like, we need the whole world's emissions to peak in 2025 and fall at 5% a year every year after that. But at the same time, we also need to think about bottom-up strategies of countries coming up with their own plans that reflect their own cultures, their own environments, their own resources. And within countries, subnational parts like states in the US, like Wisconsin, coming up with its own plans. And those now are seen as complementing each other. So you really want top-down policies, that's United Nations, and bottom-up, that's cities and states and countries doing things the way that works best for them, so that all adds up to a global drop in emissions.
Let's bring in a question with Tim in Eau Claire. Tim, hi, go ahead.
Hi, it's more of a statement that I'm hoping you can comment on. It wasn't until recently that I realized that the ocean levels aren't rising only because the ice is melting. It really, the ocean acts like a giant thermometer, and just as the mercury goes up, the level of the oceans will increase because the temperature has gone up.
Tim, thank you for that. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, so one of the impacts that people are most concerned about is sea level rise, because so much of the world's population lives close to coastlines, and there's so much development on coastlines, and if there's storms, that makes a big difference. And yeah, Tim, the caller is correct that the sea level rise that comes from a warming atmosphere comes from two sources, and it's roughly half and half. Half of it is ice sheets melting, and that contributes to more water in the ocean, but about half of it is just thermal expansion as water gets warmer, even a little bit warmer, like 1 degree or 2 degrees warmer. The ocean's big, it expands, and that, you know, gives you some sea level rise as well. So it's both of those impacts, but they both come from the same thing, from warming atmosphere that comes from greenhouse gas emissions.
UW-Madison Professor Greg Nemeth with us, works on low-carbon innovations, federal energy policy shifts, one of two dozen American scientists who worked on this major climate report from the UN panel. Let's hear from you on fossil fuels, clean energy, what you want to understand from this report. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Greg Nemeth here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about global warming, the perils of climate change across the world, with a report from the United Nations panel that is several thousand pages, urges immediate action to limit greenhouse gas emissions in all parts of the economy. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and UW-Madison Professor Greg Nemeth worked on this report, was one of the scientists. He's with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Mary Kay now in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hello.
Hi, we can hear you. What would you like to bring up about the climate?
Okay, I'd like to bring up a number of things. First of all, you can put your furnace on auto air for the summertime for your air conditioning. Okay, so you would use less air conditioning. Use more biofuels for driving. That is using our garbage as a fuel. And there's other fuels you could use I think there's 5 companies that have biofuels. We can use less energy. We can bike, motorcycle, walk, carpool. Our stop-and-go lights should be solar, and so should our outdoor solar lights. They go on and off when the sun comes out.
Mary Kay, thank you for bringing all these things up. My guess is, Greg, you will zero in there on solar. What do you hear?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Mary Kay just mentioned is really aligned with what the report is talking about, which is there are a variety of ways that we can do things to reduce emissions. And Mary Kay mentions a few that are new in the report, which is that we can actually reduce our consumption of energy and still have high well-being lifestyles and maybe even better lifestyles because we don't have air pollution that goes along with them or may find other services we would like. So things like, reducing air conditioning in the summer, switching to low impact transportation modes like biking and cycling. And then, solar energy, that's something I've studied a lot and was, a big part of my own contribution to the report. And it really has gone from something that was kind of a marginal, interesting, cool technology, 10 years ago when the last report was put together, to one now where it's growing more quickly than any other technology. It's actually a substantial part of the global energy system and really big in certain places and continues to grow, continues to get cheaper. And it starts to look like it becomes at the center of our efforts to reduce emissions. So I think Mary Kate's comments are really on with each of those points and that it takes a variety of measures to do it, but good that she mentioned solar because that's one that the report highlights as particularly important and creates really big opportunities.
I wonder where you see solar in the energy mix, what you see here in the U.S. and Wisconsin versus other parts of the world and how they regard solar, what comparisons can you draw or contrasts?
Yeah, well, overall, solar is now 3% of the world's electricity. So that sounds like maybe not that much, but it's a lot bigger than it was. And it's actually getting pretty close to, if you put wind and solar together, they're now bigger than global nuclear power, and coal power has been going down in places like the U.S. So it's really growing around the world, and it's about that same level at the U.S., and it's less in Wisconsin. So I really think there's a big opportunity in Wisconsin for, a few different things, some combination of solar energy, which we show in the report, continues to get cheaper, wind power, which continues to get cheaper, and really is developing as an offshore resource. So that's including potentially in the Great Lakes. And then using some of those clean, renewable technologies to support not just people's direct electricity use, but their transportation. So Mary Kay talked about using biofuels to substitute for gasoline. And you could also start to use electricity because we now have inexpensive batteries and electric vehicles. So the combination of all of those really provides the core to really transform our energy system around the world, but particularly in Wisconsin, where we really haven't taken advantage of the opportunities that other states and countries have so far.
You mentioned battery power. Jeff in Delafield wants to bring that up. Jeff, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. One of the concerns I have is, have we fully vetted the true cost of, or the full cost of all these so-called green energies? Batteries require a lot of minerals that have to be mined. Solar panels require a lot of acreage. Do we realize how many acres we would have to cover with glass panels and woodlands destroyed, grasslands destroyed, wetlands destroyed to provide enough power through solar? And also, how many birds are we killing with wind turbines? There's an article last week about a power company that was actually sued by the federal government for killing too many bald eagles. We're just not hearing those stories. And I'm concerned that we're not getting a full picture of what the true cost of a lot of these alternative energy sources are. Thank you.
Yes, Jeff, thank you. Greg.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad Jeff brought that up because that's something where I learned a lot in the report. You know, part of doing this report over 3 years is reading the literature, which is, you know, I think we cited 20,000 articles in the whole report, and going through various rounds of peer review. So 4 rounds where the whole report gets commented by experts and people around the world. And we have to respond to each of those comments. We got tens of thousands of comments and we responded to each of them and made changes to the text where we could. And, you know, quite a few comments for the parts that I worked on are along the lines of what Jeff mentioned. I'm thinking about what we sometimes call life cycle impacts or environmental impacts, because it's true that no energy technology is perfectly clean. And if you do it at scale, like large scale, which we need to do, they'll always have impacts. And so what we've done in that report is assess the literature on what those impacts are and catalog them where we can and quantify them where we can. And so, you know, three of them that Jeff brings up are clearly ones in the report and ones where they need some, you need to do something about them. So with batteries, you know, the minerals that are used, especially cobalt, the cost of the cobalt has been going up, but that's, you know, part of a supply chain. So the cost of the cobalt is included in the cost of the battery, cost of electric vehicle. That's fine. But, you know, there are human rights issues associated with how cobalt is mined in the Democratic Republic of Congo right now. So that has to get figured out either in terms of protecting those people and those laborers or switching to different battery chemistries that don't use cobalt as much. And recycling is one way to do that. And that's something we've especially emphasized in the report. On solar, where you install it, how you install it makes a big difference in terms of the aesthetic. So do you plant a hedgerow next to it so it's not part of the landscape? One thing that I learned quite a bit of working on the report is something called agrovoltaics, where there are a lot of crops that actually work pretty well in partial shade that solar panels give. And so there are lots of opportunities now where you can do both of those things, or put solar in places where it's low value land that isn't a source of agriculture, like deserts and stuff like that as well. So yeah, it's important issues that Jeff brings up, and it's ones that we've cataloged in the report, and some, almost all of them, you can do something about it, but it's up to us or up to governments or up to people to actually do something about it, to develop a recycling plan for batteries, to work on where and how minerals are extracted, and to think about siting for things like wind turbines and solar installations as well.
I thought it was interesting that the impact on mental health is in this report, that the stress of climate anxiety is real and you want to make sure that there is some hope left. What are your thoughts on that piece of the finding in the report?
Yeah, I think the report did go broader than it has in the past to think about the variety of impacts, including what you just mentioned. And I mean, I actually have to say, I've, you know, been working on this stuff for 20 years, and in a lot of ways, what we have now at our disposal is way better than it was even 10 years ago in terms of some of the things we've already talked about, like wind turbines, like solar, like electric vehicles. And it used to be that we would say, okay, the climate problem's really bad. It's going to be really expensive to do something about it, but it's probably worth it, so we need to make that sacrifice. But now when you look at the 24 countries that have reduced their emissions over 10 years, these aren't countries that have shrunk their economies. Mm-hmm. They're not countries that are kind of poor and are dealing with a lot of sacrifice. They've made changes that have led to increased well-being because their cities are more enjoyable to live in. Their air quality is higher. There's less kids going to the hospital as a result of it. And that all helps with climate change. So I think as we start to find ways and discover ways that people have done in other places and realize that they actually increase our well-being, that will give a lot of support to the transition, which is going to be require a lot of investment and a lot of change and persistence over decades, which is the real challenge. But if we've got the tools available and then we've got these co-benefits like health and jobs and other things like that, that's a real way that we can sustain political and public support for this effort that's going to be a decades long one.
Greg, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here. I really enjoyed speaking with you and the questions from the callers as well.
Greg Nemet is a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, one of the lead authors of the United Nations' latest climate change report. We have a link to it at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, let our fingers do the walking through the Wisconsin Blue Book. We find out what goes into producing this guidebook, this almanac to Wisconsin's government. Join in on All Things Blue Book, 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Carl Christensen brings us a story about the importance of community during trying times.
Taking notice and being thankful for the family and community we have around us often occurs when we're facing our most difficult circumstances. Writer Jan Larson brings us an essay about gratitude and the lessons learned on her journey to recovery.
I am standing on the shore, arms at my sides, hands open, palms facing the sea as gentle swells touch the shore. The horizon shows no hint of the storms to come. The first wave laps at my toes. Let's order a CT scan just to be safe, my doctor suggests. A white puff appears, dim on the horizon. Are you driving? Can you pull over? I am in Friday night Minneapolis traffic, heading to an Airbnb where my adult daughter and I will spend the weekend making COVID-19 masks, watching girl movies, and visiting over a bottle of wine. And now, swallowing fear. I'm sorry, the CT scan came back abnormal. We'll schedule an MRI for Monday. The waves cover the tops of my feet. It's a tumor, the neurosurgeon I met moments before tells me. Unable to join me during the office visit, another bit of COVID-19 fallout, my husband, Lauren, phones in from the hospital parking lot. He listens. There is nothing to say. The images tell a story. The tumor measures roughly 3 inches long by an inch wide. It has been there a while, slowly taking up space meant for my brain. My feet melt into the wet sand as the waves cover my ankles. I breathe in and blow out, trying to calm my frantic heart. We are in Rochester with yet another neurosurgeon. He assures us the tumor is benign. We cling to hope. Clouds on the horizon show hints of gray. The seas build, and I brace myself for the waves that splash white foam up my legs. It is early morning. A young resident appears at my bedside. My head is swathed in bandages a la The Mummy. Lauren already knows what I am just learning. The tumor is malignant. A rogue wave crashes the shore. I am knocked to my knees. Drenched, I struggle to regain my footing, determined to face the coming storm. The next 10 days will be consumed waiting to learn whether we have a future. Lauren insists all will be well. I want to believe, but I don't want to make promises I can't keep. I share the image of my lone vigil against the storm with our youngest son. Mom, he chides me, you need to rethink that image. You are not alone. Others are on that beach, joining hands, linking arms. What comfort those words bring. I construct visions of rows and rows of friends, family, loved ones, volunteers, medical professionals, and all those who will join me in facing the crashing waves, forming a barrier that surrounds me in love and healing. Another day, another doctor. You have a rare lymphoma. This is something you will learn to live with, not die from. There will be work ahead. It will be hard, but we can do hard. Storm clouds threaten, but hints of blue appear. I am filled with gratitude for the community that will see me through. I am not alone.
Writer Jan Larson is the chair of the Communication and Journalism Department at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
And now to the Wisconsin Blue Book, first published in 1853, about 5 years after statehood, originally a manual for lawmakers. And the nonpartisan agency, the State Legislative Reference Bureau, publishes the Blue Book on a biennial basis. You can join in on questions about it, how it comes in handy for you, the process of creating it, 800-642-1234. Jillian Slate is a managing legislative analyst with the Legislative Reference Bureau. Jillian, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, let's hear a more fuller description from you about what the Blue Book is.
So the Blue Book is a general reference book on the state of Wisconsin. It's published every 2 years, and it's especially useful as a tool for understanding Wisconsin state government, both how it works and what's happening right now. So, for example, if you're a concerned voter and you'd like to know more about who's representing you and what kind of policies are being enacted in the legislature, you can consult the Blue Book for bios of your state representative and state senator, as well as readable summaries of legislation enacted during the previous session of the legislature. Or if you're a middle school or high school student and you have to do a report on the mechanics of Wisconsin state government, there are explainers on how a bill becomes a law, how elections work in Wisconsin and who is eligible to vote, as well as summaries of all the different executive departments that make up government and what they do. Or if you're just a general researcher or a journalist, there's a wealth of statistical and historical information at the back of the Blue Book.
Yes.
That can serve as valuable context for understanding what's going on in state government. And I know that
don't give away all our secrets.
Okay. Yeah, I know recently, you know, Governor Tony Evers just took action on a bunch of bills and vetoed a bunch. And one of the tables in the back of the Blue Book came in handy because journalists could go back and see, you know, how did he stack up in terms of the number of vetoes compared to past governors? So there's information like that that can provide context for, you know, precedents of events taking place in politics and government. But there's also demographic information about the population of every Wisconsin city and town. There's information about how people voted in recent elections, both for the Assembly and the Senate, but also gubernatorial and presidential races. So there's a wealth of information at the back of the Blue Book there, and that's updated every 2 years by the LRB, or Legislative Reference Bureau, who, if you're not familiar with us, we are a nonpartisan state agency that drafts all of the bills introduced in the legislature and also provides confidential nonpartisan research services.
Do you know why the Blue Book is blue?
Well, actually, technically, it's blue because under state law, it must be blue.
The spine must be blue. Is that right? Or the whole thing?
The spine must be blue.
Okay, spine.
Just the spine. We did get in a little bit of hot water a couple of years ago for going a bit more gray on the cover. The reason why it's blue, I suspect, has something to do with the book it evolved from, which was the legislative manual you you mentioned in your intro.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little pocket-sized volume. You can sort of think of it as the equivalent of the smartphone for 1850s legislators. They would keep it in their coat pocket and pull it out to consult it for information, maybe during a committee meeting or a floor session about the rules of the legislature, maybe the Wisconsin Constitution, information about who was in the clerk's office or who were their fellow legislators. And based on some research I've done on the history of the Blue Book, it sounds like it was informally called the Blue Book for maybe 20 years before it first became named the Blue Book in 1879, because this little manual was bound in blue cloth. And so with the official name change in 1879, that name was made formal.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you mentioned the 1850s, and there's this one description in the current one that the 1850s was chaotic about voting. And, you know, it kind of says that you could vote at a store, in a saloon, in a barn, a courthouse, hotel, factory, yes, stable, saloon, even the house of a prominent resident, which I wonder how that informs our debate around ballot drop boxes today, you know, as we look at just how it was to vote in the 1850s.
You know, it's really funny because what you're referring to is the 2021 Blue Books feature article, which is about this really fascinating incident in Wisconsin history when two men who were running for governor in the 1855 election both claimed to have won, and neither backed down. And interestingly enough, my colleague Stacey Duros started doing research into that episode maybe in 2018, and we were really excited about sharing and developing her research with the general readership of the Blue Book, and we completed the article maybe in October 2020, so we had no idea that there would be this resonance with the idea of contested elections and contested election practices.
Yes.
But it really highlights the extent to which in the new state, the voting practices were really kind of ad hoc. And that applied to not only where you voted, you know, in stables and saloons and the houses of residents, of prominent residents, but also how the votes were transported to Madison, which was not very secure and certainly open to tampering, which is what actually turned out to have happened in this instance. The Board of Canvassers received the results, and they didn't like the results, so they conveniently amended them before they had to submit their final decision on who had won the election.
Wow, that history certainly insights as we live today. Don now in Sussex would like to bring up the history. Don, go ahead.
Hi, I have a couple of questions here. I've been debating this for years. I have friends who have farms that are trying to keep them going and alive, and my heart is with the history of Wisconsin, and it's scary how many farms we're losing, I would say, per week now, watching these subdivisions going up. And I'm glad I never knew this book existed. My question is, who can I contact in the governor if I get a group of people together? And let's say if a farmer doesn't have the money to put a roof on his barn, but if we can get a governor to help us do that, you know, either get money to the farmer or get money to these metal roofers for, you know, savings.
And so perhaps maybe looking more also in terms of this Blue Book on how do you connect with lawmakers on specific topics like preserving barns and roofs and the history of farming?
Well, first I'd say that if you're not aware of who your state representative or state senator is, I want to point listeners to the legislature website, which is at legis.wisconsin.gov. And it has a handy feature that you can plug your address into it and learn who your state representatives are. I found in working with legislative offices that often the best way to try to get help around a situation like the one you're describing is to contact your legislator and try to figure out what options are available. Often legislators will come to us for research about what kind of solutions could be explored. Mm-hmm. So in that circumstance, I would definitely say to get in touch with your state legislators.
Don, thanks. We have the Legislative Reference Bureau's Managing Legislative Analyst, Jillian Slate, here taking us through the Wisconsin Blue Book and what this biennial reference publication means for state government, for political history, for our civics classes. Your attachment to the Blue Book and what you wondered about it, still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jillian Slate here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the Wisconsin Blue Book, the biennial almanac of Wisconsin government. The next edition is in production. There was commotion when the 2017-2018 edition came out, as the book had a gray cover with the spine staying blue. That's a mandate in state law. Still time to bring up the Blue Book, 800-642-1234. Jillian Slate of the LRB, the Legislative Reference Bureau, which is behind this reference book, stays with us. So, Jillian, the Blue Book editions, they contain maps of each lawmaker's district. And as we know, redistricting has been tied up in the state Supreme Court. How does that have delays in being able to put the details of the maps into the drafting of the Blue Book?
Well, it all depends on whether those maps change again, which is anyone's guess. But the truth is that everything is always changing with the Blue Book, so the issue of maps constantly changing is not something new to us. Every biennium, there are special elections called right before the Blue Book has to go to print. There are people who are appointed to executive boards last minute. Legislators' committee assignments are changed. So we're pretty accustomed to changing content at the last minute before it goes to the printer. But also now that we have the option of posting the Blue Book online, we can also revise it online. So just as a reminder to listeners, while the physical Blue Book is a great resource, you can also access all of the content on the LRB website, which is at legis.wisconsin.gov/LRB. Mm-hmm. And if perchance the maps change after we go into print, those changes will be reflected on our website. So that will always have up-to-date information. And also we encourage people to contact the LRB directly, because we're able to generate and provide analysis of maps as they change.
Why continue to print physical copies of this book?
That's an interesting question, and to be honest, we talk about it, at least for the past few Blue Book seasons that I've been around. One of the issues I've worked on as an analyst is broadband availability, and there's still a broad swath of the state that doesn't have access to some of the online resources that we use to compile the Blue Book, or people don't have the expertise to know where to find that information. So we think of it as a way to compile and make convenient a lot of information that's available, you know, in disparate corners of the web and things that we compile from different state and federal agencies. It's something we put together and is accessible to Wisconsinites in one place. Mm. In addition to, you know, people who don't necessarily have internet access, I know it's a handy reference for incarcerated populations who can access all of this current information if they don't have independent access to the internet.
Jillian Slate with us, managing legislative analyst with the State Legislative Reference Bureau, as we explore the Wisconsin Blue Book, how it comes together, this reference book on all things state government. Still taking your questions, 800-642-1234. So this edition you're working on, you are featuring a chapter on basically talking with Capital News Media correspondents. Is that what that's about?
Correct. Yeah. So in the past, the feature article at the center of each Blue Book has explored something unique about Wisconsin history or society, and it often represents the culmination of some work that someone has been doing at the agency and wants to share with the readership of the Blue Book. This year, well, for 2023, I'm already into the next year, we're looking forward to sort of use the feature article to introduce this larger research project we're doing about the political press in Wisconsin and how it's changed over time. Hmm. And it kind of grew out of the fact that I'm so reliant, and I don't think this is just true of political insiders. It's true if you're a casual observer of government or politics, but we're so reliant on the press to understand what's going on in our state governments. And I've always been curious to know what it's like to cover state politics and government and how that's changed over the past 10, 20, 50 years. So how social media has changed that, how different media models and changes in newspaper circulation have changed what it means to cover the Capitol, how the pandemic has changed the job of covering politics. And we're hoping to address some of those questions with these oral history interviews with current and past members of the press corps, and then share those findings with people in the 2023 Blue Book.
So leaning more on oral histories than on digging through archives, it sounds like.
Well, I've done some archival research so far, but the tricky thing about studying the press is that often research for the Blue Book involves poring over old newspapers, but the press don't write about themselves. They're very modest. although there are some archival collections at the Wisconsin Historical Society that are papers and letters left by people who were Capitol correspondents, it's a lot less common than archival collections of people who served in government. So it makes it kind of a trickier task to tell the story of the Capitol Press Corps.
Quickly, as we're out of time, do other states have blue books, or are we unique?
Well, I think Wisconsin, other states do have similar reference books, but I think ours is more robust and really testifies to the fact that we have this robust support structure for the legislature that provides research and information both to legislators and the public. And the Blue Book is sort of a manifestation of that.
Jillian, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Jillian Slate is a managing legislative analyst at the State Legislative Reference Bureau. We have a link to the Blue Book that is online at WPR.org/mornings. And just ahead, we explore the history of Wisconsin's first Black-owned brewery. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.